Hello, and welcome to Words on Film, the spoken word podcast dedicated to moving pictures. I'm Dan Burke, your host and movie critic, and I'm here to tell you exactly what I think of some of the latest movies out right now.
I have quite a few movies to review for you for this show. I didn't get to all the brand new movies that I wanted to review. For instance, The King of Staten Island is a movie directed by Judd Apatow and starring Pete Davidson of Saturday Night Live. That's one I really wanted to see, but I didn't get the chance to do it. So I will try to get to it next week. Meanwhile, I will give you all the brand new and new enough films that I've seen this past week, beginning with unquestionably, the newest film that I have to review for you for the show. So, the first movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is Da Five Bloods, which is the latest movie or joint from, you guessed it, director Spike Lee. And this is his first feature film since Black Klansman, which came out 2 years ago and deservedly was nominated for Best Picture at the Oscars. It earned Spike Lee his first Academy Award nomination as Best Director, making him the sixth black man and the fifth African American to be nominated for the award. But as I said in my review way back when in 2018, he really should have been the first to receive such a nomination. But he's still going strong with Da Five Bloods. Granted, Black Klansman was a comeback for Spike Lee, even though he never stopped making films, but that was his highest quality film in probably about 10 to 15 years. And he continues that tradition with Da Five Bloods, which tells the story about four African-American vets, Vietnam vets, who battled the forces of man and nature when they returned to Vietnam, present day, seeking the remains of their fallen squad leader and the gold fortune he helped them hide. The actors who play the four Vietnam veterans are Delroy Lindo, arguably the best known of the four, Clark Peters, Norm Lewis, and Isaiah Whitlock Jr. So Delroy Lindo has been in a number of films. He's been in a couple of films directed by Spike Lee, most notably Crooklyn, which is Spike Lee's only PG-13, well, actually, maybe it's not his only PG-13 directed film, but he was in Malcolm X, he was in Crooklyn, and I think that just about does it for him in Spike Lee films. The other three actors aren't quite as well known by name, but if you see them in this movie, you've definitely seen them in other movies and TV shows, particularly Isaiah Whitlock Jr. and Clark Peters. Isaiah Whitlock Jr. has been in several Spike Lee films, including The 25th Hour and She Hate Me, but he and Clark Peters were both in the highly celebrated HBO show The Wire, where they both were series regulars of that show. Norm Lewis is not, I think, is probably the least familiar of the four, but I know I've seen him actually in Les Miserables, or at least on TV, when Les Miserables, the stage show, has been aired on PBS in stage format. He's an excellent actor, but not one you've seen as much on TV as you have on the Broadway stage. But either way, all four of these actors really had some good chemistry going on and made me really believe that they had been together for years, even though this is probably the first time that all four of them had worked together. You could also be a little bit technical and say they might seem a little young to be Vietnam veterans, but actually, Isaiah Whitlock, Clark Peters, and Delroy Lindo are all in their 60s by now, and they could have conceivably been in Vietnam, but my guess is they actually haven't. Norm Lewis, on the other hand, was born in 1963, so the fall of Saigon happened in 1975 when he was 12, so there is no conceivable way that Norm Lewis could have ever served in Vietnam, but still, I just knew that fact from looking him up. I think the four of them are believable as former Vietnam soldiers, and I think they work well together in that regard. And the story really takes off when the four of them return to Saigon on a mission. And I gotta give Spike Lee a lot of credit. Modern day Saigon looks beautiful. I'm not sure if Vietnam is still a communist country anymore, but it's probably, I think, more democratic than it was after the Vietnam War when the communists just completely took over. And man, Saigon looks so good in this movie, I'd love to go visit it. It does obviously look like the corporations have gotten in there, but it still is an amazing city. But the story really progresses when the four of them actually go to the more rural sections of Vietnam, particularly where they fought back in the late 60s and early 70s, and try to retrieve the gold fortune that their fallen squad leader, who goes by the name of Stormin Norman, and is played here by arguably the most well-known member of the cast, Chadwick Boseman. I was going mid-sentence there. I forgot where I was going with that. But anyway, they go into the Vietnam jungle not only to retrieve this gold, but also to track down the remains of Stormin Norman. And it actually is kind of amazing that the remains of a Vietnam soldier are still in Vietnam. I'm not sure if there are many other American soldiers whose remains are still there, but it is quite possible that there would be. And joining the four Vietnam veterans on their journey is Delroy Lindo's character's estranged son, David, with whom he has a contentious relationship. And David is played by Jonathan Myers as a 30-something young man who accompanies the four of them because, let's face it, if somebody was looking for gold, you'd probably want to help them and reap the benefits. But it's more than greed that takes David along with his father and his three comrades. And the actor, by the way, Jonathan Majors, has, to my knowledge, not acted in a Spike Lee film previous to Defive Bloods. But he's probably best known to moviegoers, particularly those who attend indie films, as the star of The Last Black Man in San Francisco, which is a movie I regretfully have not seen yet. But if I do get to see that movie, which came out last year, I will definitely review it on the show, and I'll let you know what I think. So I'd like to delve more into the plot and some of the strong supporting characters here, but I really don't want to, because this is a movie that begs to be experienced. And by that I mean, you really have to see it and get into it to really appreciate the film. And I think that my revealing to you whether or not these four Vietnam veterans were successful in finding this gold and finding the remains of their comrades would ruin at least part of the experience here. But there are a lot of unexpected surprises, and I think that Delroy Lindo in particular stands out in this crowd. And that's not to discredit Clark Peters, Norm Lewis, and Isaiah Whitlock Jr. They do well here, but Delroy Lindo's character is arguably the most developed, and he's probably also the most most of an antagonist here. But Delroy Lindo does play a very complicated character. For instance, to give you an idea of how complicated his character not only has a contentious relationship with his biological son, but he also is a Trump supporter. And through a lot of this movie, he wears a MAGA hat. And a lot of people are going to be particularly mad about that. Maybe not people who watch Fox News, but you kind of know when a character in a Spike Lee movie or a Spike Lee joint is wearing a MAGA hat that it's not particularly good. And some people might be wondering why a black man would support Donald Trump, although I know several black Trump supporters. What I don't understand is how a Vietnam veteran could support Trump. I just don't understand that, but I know there are Vietnam veterans out there who do. I also don't understand why evangelists have thrown their support behind Trump, but they have. Let's face it. 62 million Americans voted for Trump, and obviously it's been a diverse crowd. Probably not as diverse as the 65 million who voted for Hillary Clinton, but you know they're out there. And I do kind of wish that some more of the characters would have been more developed. Like, for instance, Isaiah Whitlock Jr.'s character, I thought was the least developed of the four. You learn about Norm Lewis's character from his telling and not the movie showing. And you learn actually enough about Clark Peters, including the fact that he had a liaison with a Vietnamese woman when he was stationed there. And there are some interesting surprises with that liaison, including how this former flame of his still looks after 45 years after the war ended, as well as her particular family relations, which I won't give away. So, Defy of Bloods is not as strong a movie as Black Klansman, but I do think it follows a positive trajectory in Spike Lee's later repertoire. I thought it was a fascinating film. It definitely makes the most out of its on-location shooting in Vietnam itself. And I did really buy all four of these actors as former Vietnam War veterans, with Delroy Lindo's character somehow being the only one who experiences PTSD symptoms. Again, I don't think that's particularly accurate, and I do wish that the other three characters, or at least one other character amongst the four, would have been more developed, but it is still a fascinating and vibrant movie, and it's also one of the few films about the Vietnam War, not only one that takes place in Vietnam, but also takes place after Vietnam, where the focus is on African-American soldiers. Not a lot of other movies do that. One of the only ones I could think of that made the other black soldiers into round characters was the movie Platoon, which had very strong supporting performances by African-American actors like Forrest Whitaker and Keith David, amongst others. And maybe Good Morning Vietnam, too, but I probably put Platoon there because it actually shows round African-American characters in combat and experiencing the same thing as their white counterparts. And Platoon had them as supporting characters, which is fine, but you don't see a lot of other movies about that are solely focused on African-American veterans. The only other one I can think of is Dead Presidents. And that movie was good. It was a bit flawed, but Defy of Bloods is certainly probably the best movie about, solely about African-American veterans. And it gets my rating of a knockout. It's a movie that can be funny. It can be heartbreaking. It's a movie that forgive me for using a hackneyed cliche, but it does keep you on the edge of your seat in certain instances, and I really don't want to give away the rest of the movie because it is a movie that really has to be experienced, and thankfully, since it is a Netflix original, you can see it in your own home if you have a Netflix subscription, and I highly recommend that you do. Having said that, I still would have liked to have seen this movie in theaters because it is 2 hours and 34 minutes long. And with my work schedule, since I'm not a full-time film critic as of yet, I don't have time to sit down and watch a 2.5-hour movie, let alone a 3-hour movie like The Irishman, and, you know, still stay awake and also still have time to get up at a reasonable hour the next morning to go to the job of mine that actually pays. But I'm not complaining. Defy of Bloods is a great film. It is among Spike Lee's best. I wouldn't call it his very best, but it's definitely probably up there in the top 10, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. We'll be right back. movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is another Netflix original, which is called The Half of It. It is a PG-13 rated teen romance drama with some comedic elements to it as well. And it first hit Netflix on May 1st. But it hit Netflix when this show was on a one-month hiatus due to technical difficulties. But it really is a unique film. And when I say teen romance, that probably brings to mind several other cliches, some of which are probably John Hughes films. But this movie, to its credit, doesn't seem like an imitation of a John Hughes movie, particularly because the protagonist in it is a Chinese-American. So this is a film that takes place in the Pacific Northwest, in a small town there. It doesn't specify what state, I don't think, but it presumably takes place in either Washington State or rural Oregon. And it revolves around a very smart, but cash-strapped teenager by the name of Ellie Chu, who is of Chinese descent. I think she's definitely born into a Chinese family. Her father is full-blooded Chinese, and he works at a railway junction in the small town, and she also assists him with his work in the train station. But Ellie agrees to write a love letter for a jock who's not particularly the sharpest knife in the drawer. But when she agrees to write this love letter for him to a woman that A, he doesn't know particularly well, but is attracted to, and B, she is attracted to on a deeper level, it becomes an interesting love triangle, but becomes even more interesting when she does not expect to become this boy's friend, or, for that matter, as I told you before, fall for his crush. Ellie Chu is played by a young actress of, I believe, Chinese descent, whose name is Leia Lewis. And I don't have any details for you about how old she is. I assume she's either in her late teens or early 20s, but this is her very first film where she is the lead actress. She also has a supporting role on a TV series called Nancy Drew, where she plays, I think, Nancy Drew's ally, Georgia George Fan. She's also been in TV series like Station 19, The Gifted, Charm, The Good Doctor, and others. And a lot of her repertoire so far has consisted of a lot of TV series and some short films. She's been in a couple of films, although in very small parts, but this is a very impressive debut by Leia Lewis. And I think that she actually works very well off of the jock who she's writing love letters using his name. That actor, whose character's name is Paul Munsky, is played by Daniel Deemer, who is a young actor I've never seen before, but he's been in such movies as The Man in the High Castle, as well as Sacred Lies. So he's an actor who's been in several shorts and TV movies. The Man in High Castle, by the way, is not a movie. I'm sorry about that. It's a TV series. And he was in one episode of that show. And actually, to Daniel Deemer's credit, he could have taken a role that didn't require very much forethought and could have played it as a stereotype, because the dumb jock is definitely a very hackneyed stereotype. But to Daniel Deemer's credit, he adds a bit more dimension. No, his character is not particularly smart, but he seemed to be dim in a realistic kind of way. And also his reasons for trying to woo the character Aster, who's played by a lovely young actress by the name of Alexis Lemire, are actually kind of realistic. And he's telling his new friend Ellie that he loves her, but he hasn't actually spoken to her. And as much as many of us do not want to admit this, we've all been there. We've had those moments, especially when we were adolescents, where we had feelings for someone, whether they were feelings of attraction or something deeper than that. We couldn't really differentiate between liking someone, loving someone, and being in love with them. And in some extreme circumstances, there are some people who can't quite tell the difference between being in a loving relationship and being obsessed with someone. But fortunately, the movie kind of took that in stride and didn't quite go that creepy route. But I really appreciated this movie because I grew up in a town a lot like the one in The Half of It. I didn't grow up in the Pacific Northwest, but I did grow up in one of those towns that was kind of in the middle of nowhere, only had a couple hundred students in the high school. Minorities were scarce. In fact, there's not a single black person in this movie, which is realistic of a lot of probably hundreds, if not thousands, of rural towns in America. And even somebody who is of Asian descent is rare in these kinds of towns. But besides the racial inequity, I could also completely relate to the people in this movie who were the big fish in a small pond, or who had college, aka bigger city ambitions, leaving the town, knocking the dust off their boots. I could completely relate to that. And yeah, there have been hundreds, if not thousands, of movies, not to mention books, that have that kind of plot. But The Half of It had a more unique and realistic feel to it than a lot of other teen movies that I've seen before. The people in this movie, regardless of whether or not they were teens or somewhere in their early to mid-20s, made me believe that they were teenagers. And also, the having a crush on someone scenario is very, very realistic, considering that, well, longer ago than I'd like to admit, I was kind of in that same boat too. And let's face it, if you're really honest with yourself, you were probably there as well. I should also note that The Half of It has been written and directed by Alice Wu, who is a native of San Jose, California. So I can't exactly say whether or not this is autobiographical. I can't say for sure because I don't know Alice Wu's previous life other than some other movies she's directed. And this is actually the first movie that Alice Wu has directed and written in 16 years. Before this, she had a film called Saving Face, which came out in 2004, and I have not actually seen this film. It doesn't have anybody particularly well-known in it, but it is a film where the protagonist is a Chinese-American woman who also happens to be a lesbian. And I'm not going to assume, based on those two plots, that Alice Wu is a lesbian, but I think there is some truth to this movie, particularly having an Asian American protagonist in a largely white town, where Alice Wu may have pulled some of her experiences, and especially considering that she is the sole writer of this movie, having written the screenplay and the story. I should have reversed that: story and the screenplay, because the story comes first and then the screenplay. But you know exactly what I mean. I would be willing to bet that at least half of this movie was probably based on real life experience. And that does not take away from the film at all. It shouldn't. I actually really appreciated this film for its universality, how I could relate to living in this kind of town, feeling like an outcast. Maybe because I'm white, I wasn't the kind of outcast that the character Ellie was here, but I can relate to a lot of complicated feelings that are brilliantly presented in this film. They were brilliantly written by Alice Wu, and they were brilliantly acted by particularly the three main characters of this film, who were played by Lea Lewis, who I'm going to look out for later, Daniel Deemer, who I'm probably going to see in another film sometime soon, and Alexis Lemire. It's a really great film. I'm really glad it's on Netflix so as many people can see it as possible. And it is a knockout. This is probably the best teen romance movie I've seen in a really long time. It's a movie that did not get in the hands of Nicholas Sparks, who really kind of took the teen romance, or should I say the early 20s romance, and formulated it even more than it even needed to be formulated. But I loved the half of it because of its unique characters and its well-written story, which really dodged a lot of cliches and became something really unpredictable, which I can definitely appreciate, especially in an independent film. I'm going to be reviewing for you is another Netflix original, because let's face it, that's my primary source of original movies these days. I'm going to try to make it so it's not my sole source, but you know what? A great movie is a great movie, whether you go to the theaters to see it, which is not an option right now, or if you stream it. But I highly prefer to see a movie, regardless of whether it's good or bad, in the theaters, but of course, that's not an option right now. So, the next movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is The Wrong Missy. This is the latest film from Happy Madison Productions. It does not have Adam Sandler in it, although Adam Sandler does produce. It does star David Spade, Nick Swardson, and Lauren Lapkus. Probably the least familiar name of those three is Lauren Lapkus, but you probably know Lauren Lapkus as from her recurring role as a prison guard on Orange is the New Black. She also had some visible supporting roles in movies like Jurassic World and the much maligned Holmes and Watson. And even if you hated the movie Holmes and Watson, which I didn't, think it was a great movie, but I didn't think it was as terrible as other people thought it was, you definitely remember Lauren Lapkus from those movies. And she is an actress and a comedian who certainly has a distinct look to her. I think she could probably be easily compared to Kristen Schaal from Flight of the Conchords, and may even be mistaken for her because they do have some similar appearances. But I do actually think she's a very good actress. I was very impressed with her in Orange is the New Black, where she actually wasn't funny, but she was certainly a very warm character and a very interesting character. The Wrong Missy, keeping in a troubling trend with other Happy Madison movies, doesn't give her a very good platform to showcase her talents as an actress and as a comic actress, because Happy Madison Productions is very, how do I say this? It hates women. Yeah. It certainly has a bias towards New Englanders, to which I can certainly point out, since I lived in New England for the first 36 years of my life. And it also, particularly when you watch movies like That's My Boy or The Do-Over, which was the last film that I remember with David Spade in it, and man, do I wish I didn't remember it. These are flagrantly misogynistic films. The women who are in the movie are either heartless shrews or they're sluts. And I think that The Wrong Missy, to its credit, does less of the slut shaming, but the women who are, you know, obnoxious in this film are really, really obnoxious, almost to the point of extremity. And I think Lauren Lapkus in this film, her character, whose name is Melissa or Missy, is one of those people. But I delved into what's wrong with it. Let me tell you about the plot. It revolves around a guy named Tim, who's a mild-mannered professional played by David Spade, who is single and is inviting the woman of his dreams, who is this nearly perfect woman and therefore a very flat character, who's played by Molly Sims, on a work retreat to Hawaii. But he realizes too late he mistakenly texted someone with the same first name from a nightmare blind date. So he meets Molly Sims's character in an airport, and through an understandable mistaken identity, he thinks that she is the woman with whom he's texting. But then he finds out that another woman named Melissa, who's played by Lauren Lapkus, who is probably on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the most annoying, is probably about a 15. And in a very, very unrealistic way. I mean, Lauren Lapkus, and I don't blame her for the way her character is in this film. I blame the screenwriters. I do think that Lauren Lapkus takes this part and does what she can with it, but it doesn't have any real dimension to it. I mean, she is just extremely annoying. She doesn't seem to know her boundaries in any sense of the word. She doesn't think, particularly when David Spade's character is on a work retreat, that maybe she shouldn't show up to a work retreat where his coworkers and his boss are, and do really obnoxious things like swear like a sailor and even kind of dry hump things, which Lauren Lapkus actually does in this film. The biggest problem with this film is you have women who are major characters in this film. They are either perfect or, in Lauren Lapkus's character's case, extremely obnoxious. I do give this movie credit for not slut-shaming, unlike The Do-Over, but that's still not a ton of credit. But one of the biggest problems with this movie was that it was written, story and screenplay, by Chris Pappas and Kevin Barnett. Who are these guys? I don't know. But the problem is that they're guys. And that goes into that old Hollywood idea that women can write women and men can write anyone. Now, there are some men who should not write women. And I really think that this movie would have benefited from having a woman co-write this movie. Maybe looking at the way that Lauren Lapkus's Missy character is written and probably suggest maybe she shouldn't be written like this. Maybe she should have some redeeming qualities. And her character does have redeeming qualities, particularly as David Spade's character starts to have more feelings for her. But by the time she does, it's too little too late. And she acts so obnoxious through about 80% of this film that you kind of wonder why David Spade's character doesn't just throw her off a cliff, which he does actually consider doing at one point in this film. It's not particularly funny when the part happens, but you can understand David Spade's frustration. And unlike The Do-Over, David Spade is actually not the guy at fault here in this movie. I think he actually does pretty well playing a relatable guy in this film. And I do kind of give Happy Madison Productions a teensy bit of credit for playing to David Spade's strengths, either as a relatable guy or as a bitterly sarcastic guy. It worked for him on Saturday Night Live, and it's worked for him in some movies, but not all. Having said that, the movie has Nick Swardson in it, and I cannot figure out for the life of me, A, why Nick Swardson is a working actor, and B, what deal he made with the devil, or what sexual favors he made for the people at Happy Madison Productions to get him in films. Because this guy is box office poison. He is always in these Happy Madison movies, and only Happy Madison movies. He always plays this obnoxious schmuck. And in this film, he plays a character who is so obnoxious that it's a wonder how he has not gotten fired for his behavior in the job in which he works. He's supposed to be this guy who is a tech wizard, but he's one of these guys who doesn't act particularly intelligently. And I really think that his role should have gone to a more talented comic actor like Terry Crews, provided that he was written better. Now, this movie also features Rob Schneider in a supporting role, but to this movie's credit, Rob Schneider is A, not obnoxious in this film, and B, also does not play a hurtful stereotype of somebody who's Japanese or Mexican or any of the other jaw-droppingly insensitive stereotypes that Rob Schneider has played in Happy Madison films. And even when he's played, you know, somebody of his own race, like in the Deuce Bigelow movies, those movies haven't been particularly funny either. I do think that Rob Schneider is a talented comedic actor, and I have seen him. He was great on Saturday Night Live back in the early 90s, even when he was doing the Making Copies guy. Those sketches were actually really funny. And he was funny in some other films like Home Alone 2, but Happy Madison really has not done him any favors since the late 90s. Of course, that "you can do it" phrase, it probably is his catchphrase since he said it in The Waterboy, but since probably The Waterboy, he hasn't been particularly relatable in any of his other movies or TV shows. But in this movie, his character is a bit more of an improvement. Not much of an improvement, but a bit more. So The Wrong Missy is a big miss in the sense that the real thing that's working against this is Happy Madison Productions' deep-seated foundation of hatred of women. And if Happy Madison Productions and Adam Sandler and the people who work there want to prove me or any other critics wrong, they're welcome to do so. And I thought actually last year when Adam Sandler was in the decent Netflix film Murder Mystery, it wasn't a great film, but I think as far as Adam Sandler comedies go, it probably was his best since the remake of The Longest Yard. But the reason that movie worked was because it had Jennifer Aniston in it. It did not exploit her for the way she looked, and the other characters in the movie were not written offensively. And I thought, based on Murder Mystery, that future Happy Madison production films would be written with better characters who are less offensive and who are, God forbid, actually funny. But as I said, The Wrong Missy is a big miss, and it is a strikeout. The reason I'm not giving it a flunk out is it does some things wrong. It actually utilizes David Spade's strengths really well. Rob Schneider's performance is a slight improvement, but it made two big mistakes. One, its deep-seated hatred of women, and two, casting Nick Swardson in it. Seriously, what is the deal with Nick Swardson? Why is he still acting in films, even if they're all Happy Madison films? And why have the people at Happy Madison not realized that Nick Swardson is not a funny actor or doesn't usually play somebody who is even the slightest bit likable? I don't get it, but that's The Wrong Missy and Happy Madison Productions for you. The next movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is one that is a Netflix original, but came out quite a while ago, about 9 months ago. But I reviewed it when my show was still on hiatus, and I might as well get to it now because this is an interesting film. It's one that's called Tall Girl, and it tells the story about a girl in high school who I think is a senior in high school, although I can't quite remember. Her name is Jody. And at 6'1.5", She is the tallest girl in her high school, and she has always felt uncomfortable in her own skin. Typical high school. And I'm not saying that as a high school movie cliche. It is typical of high school students. We've all been there. But after years of literally slouching, being made fun of, and in some cases avoiding attention at all costs, which can't be easy for the tallest girl in a school, Jody finally decides to find the confidence to, literally and figuratively, stand tall. Jody is played by a real-life tall girl by the name of Ava Michelle. And Ava Michelle is very pretty, although I'm going to limit my comments about her looks because she might still be under 18. And I don't want to touch that with a 20-foot pole. But Ava Michelle, I think, acts pretty well here and certainly takes her probably real-life experiences being self-conscious about being tall. And I never quite understood, when it comes to women, being tall being a liability. I mean, there are women, not only in high school, but in the real world, who are tall, i.e. 5 feet 10 inches or above, who are gorgeous. I mean, Tyra Banks is, I think, 5 foot 11. Elle McPherson is 6 feet tall. Carly Kloss is 6 foot 2. And I don't think their height works against them. They're considered the most beautiful women in the world. So I don't really understand why being tall for some women is seen as a liability. But in the world in which we live, it kind of is. And I guess it depends on where you live in the world, particularly in the Western world. I don't think that being tall as a woman is particularly looked upon as an asset. I think it might have to do with the way guys perceive you, because a guy being shorter than a woman, I get how there's a stigma to that, but it does happen. What I don't understand about this film, though, is that 6 feet, 1.5 inches is tall. It's certainly taller than the average height for both men and women, particularly in the Western world, but it's not gargantuanly tall. You know, I don't think it's, for lack of a better term, freakishly tall. Because there was one time where I was watching TLC, and there was a show that was on. I only watched about 5 minutes of it, but it was a story, or rather, it's not really a story because it's a reality show, but it revolved around a girl in high school who was 6 feet 9 inches tall. That's really tall for anyone, let alone a woman. So somebody who's that tall, who probably towers over everyone in the school, I wouldn't be surprised. There you have a story. But somebody who's 6 foot 1.5, taller than average, yes. Exceptionally tall, probably not. And the movie seemed to have not only other women not be as tall as her, but it also didn't seem to have many guys except for one foreign exchange student who becomes the tentative love interest for Jody in this film, who seems to be the only guy in the entire school who's over 6 feet tall. And, you know, unfairly or not, love it or hate it, being tall for a guy is an asset. And I particularly know that. I'm not bragging, but I'm just saying, at 6 foot 3.5, being tall certainly has its advantages being a guy. But I'm just going to move on before I get into too much trouble. So I did like the originality of the movie Tall Girl. It's certainly one of those subjects of a teen movie that you don't see in typical teen films. You don't see women who are, you know, particularly have a certain trait of theirs that can be seen as a liability. And I think that this movie does that particularly well. And I also really liked the relationship between Ava Michelle's character and her parents, particularly her father, who's played in this movie by Steve Zahn. And Steve Zahn is a very underrated actor. He's still getting a lot of supporting roles, but I think people know him from some of his comedies like Happy Texas or the first three Diary of a Teenage Wimp movies. Oh, I'm sorry, not Diary of a Teenage Wimp, Diary of a Wimpy Kid movies. And I also particularly liked the relationship that Jody, the character, has with her younger sister, Harper, who is this woman of probably below average height, probably about 5 feet, 5 foot two, which amazingly is an asset for women, who's played by Sabrina Carpenter. And Harper is one of these women who is very popular, not only because of her height, but also because she's very pretty and she basically has a pre-adult career taking part in beauty pageants, but she's also not a shallow person. And I really appreciated that. And there were some other characters here who were good for their parts in the film, but I think they were a little too good to be true. Like, for instance, there's a best friend in this film that Jody has who is named Farida, and she's played by Angelica Washington, who kind of seems too good to be true as a best friend. Of course, you know, the black girl in the movie is usually the best friend. That's been a trait for decades in movies, and there's not really very much wrong with that. But I did think that there wasn't very much to the character of Farida other than sticking up for her tall best friend. Granted, she's a really great friend in this film, but I didn't perceive any particular weaknesses other than her just being a little too perfect of a friend and a little too convenient to be an ally. But I did enjoy her performance, and she was very funny in the film. And I also liked how the film avoided some teen movie pitfalls and also was a bit less predictable than I would have expected. The movie actually was written, a story and screenplay by Sam Wolfson, who's a man, but he's one of the men who actually write women particularly well. I just kind of wish that some of the other women in the film, actually some of the other characters in the film, could have been a lot more developed and maybe taken fewer pages out of movies like Pretty in Pink, for instance. But Tall Girl is an enjoyable film. I just didn't think it was a great film. I think that there were relatable moments in this movie, but again, maybe it's my confusion with a woman being tall being a liability, because I don't quite necessarily see it that way, but maybe I'm the only one here. But Tall Girl is a checkout, because I did like Ava Michelle in the movie, and I'm hoping if she really wants to develop herself as an actress, she'll go after this to other roles or be given other roles later on in movies that are kind of beyond I'm tall and therefore the outcast, you know, or a little bit just deviating from that. Because if she's typecast as the awkward tall girl for the rest of her career, eventually her movie career will lose steam. But Ava Michelle is actually a dancer by trade, I guess you could call it by trade. And you don't, she's on a reality show competition, or she was. And if you could just excuse me for a minute, I will just look up what that competition is. Okay, let's see. Self. Oh, she was in Dance Moms, which was a TV series that aired on cable from 2014 to 2017. She obviously wasn't the mom, but yeah, that would be super awkward. But yeah, she played herself. She was known as Ava Coda at the time, and her acting name or her stage name is Ava Michelle. And according to IMDb, this is her first film. So somebody having their first film where they're the starring role, whether or not it's a great film or not, is certainly very impressive. She's only been in a couple of other short films before this and had a recurring role on The Bold and the Beautiful, but I hope that she has roles later in the future, because even though Tall Girl wasn't a great film, I did think that her acting and particularly her relatability in being the awkward person because of one particular liability served her very well in this film. She reflected that very well, is what I'm trying to say. I have run out of movies to talk about for this program because I reviewed four of them that I saw relatively recently. And even though Tall Girl debuted on Netflix in September, I think I saw it a little later after it came out, as in October. But I might as well tell you, once I bring it up, some of the newer films that are coming out. There is one movie that is coming out presumably in theaters, but probably also in streaming, because streaming is really the only way that a lot of these films are making their money right now. And the movie is called Kajillionaire. This is a movie about a woman's life who's turned upside down when her criminal parents invite an outsider to join them on a major heist they're planning. This already sounds like an amazing plot. Somebody who is reluctantly brought into the family business, particularly when the family business is illegal. Sounds just like Michael Corleone, all the way. Which brought out three amazing performances by Al Pacino, two of which were in timeless films. I'm, of course, excluding The Godfather Part 3. Al Pacino was excellent in that film, you know, for all intents and purposes, but overall, The Godfather 3 was a little too flawed to be considered seriously with the rest of the Godfather saga. But anyway, Kajillionaire is directed by a woman by the name of Miranda July. And Miranda July has been in the movie business for quite some time. She's actually a native of Vermont, which is quite interesting. In terms of movies she's directed, before Kajillionaire, she directed one in 2011 called The Future that actually stars her. Yeah, she directed her own performance, which is quite amazing. You don't see that a lot, but, you know, some directors have certainly done that, both on a large scale and in several, maybe too many to count, indie films. And she also directed another film that I remember hearing about from 2005, but I don't actually recall seeing it. But it's a movie called Me and You and Everyone We Know. And that film starred John Hawkes, the Academy Award nominated actor, also Miranda July herself, and Miles Thompson and a couple of other actors. I'd like to see that film if it comes up on my radar sometime soon. And by radar, I mean, is it available for me to stream easily? Or I got to get something like Amazon Prime where I can stream whatever films I want, because we're living in a day and age where video stores are basically obsolete, and for particularly valid reasons. There probably are some video stores out there, but they are, rest assured, few and far between. Actually, by the time I moved out of Boston, there was only one video store that was still literally standing in Boston.
Well, that's all the time I have for this episode of Words on Film. I always love talking about movies, and I hope you liked what you heard. If you did, please subscribe and rate the show and leave comments if you can. I would love to get your feedback, even if it's more criticism than praise. This has been Words on Film. I'm Dan Burke, and until my next episode, I'll see you at the movies.